those of you that we haven't met, I'm Wendy and this is Beth from the CANNP. I want to welcome you to our latest Tag the Expert. We're pleased to have Dr. Eric Marsden here to speak to us about the importance of nutrition in the prevention and treatment of cancer. After completing a degree in human biology, Dr. Marsden became a naturopath and he holds numerous postgraduate certifications. He's also received extensive training in various cancer therapies from several distinguished clinics and teaching institutions in Germany. Dr. Marsden has received many awards for clinical excellence, including most recently the OND Chair's Award for Outstanding Contribution to the Naturopathic Profession. He's appeared on television and has been quoted extensively in print. So please join me in welcoming international lecturer Dr. Eric Marsden.
It's Eric. So this is a topic I'm quite passionate about. My clinical practice is I would say the vast majority of it is either chronic and complex cases, but predominantly cancer and oncology. When we talk about the role of nutrition in cancer, I think most of us get a sense of its preventive role, which is extraordinarily important, but it also has a role in treatment, in palliative care. So it has a role all throughout. We tend to underestimate the importance of nutrition. So I'm actually going to be mainly talking about diet. But while we were, just talking in our preamble, I realized what we'll maybe talk about is some other preventive strategies. You know, I give a talk at several conventions, actually, where we've talked about we found the cure for cancer, and really that prevention is the cure. And I think we underestimate actually how much prevention is the cure. The research does tell us that probably about 80 to 90% of cancers are preventable. Really only about 5 to 10% of cancers are genetic in nature, truly genetic in nature. So let's talk about nutrition. And when we talk about nutrition, conventionally, I'll talk about the approach that's usually taken. And really, conventionally, the single greatest concern to conventional oncology teams is cachexia, or significant weight loss. And part of it is because it's known that substantial weight loss results in immune suppression and overall bad prognosis. The problem is that it's become a goal in and of itself. So patients are often advised to eat horribly, I think from our standards probably, with the eye to keeping as much weight as possible, so eating very calorie-dense foods, but certainly not nutritionally dense foods. I remember very early on when I started practicing integrative cancer therapies, getting a book from Princess Margaret about nutrition and cancer. On the front cover were pictures of cakes and ice cream and cookies and candies and so on. I do believe they've come a little bit since then, although not much. The book is still around, and a patient recently brought it in as well. So there still is this concept that more is more, meaning more food, more calories, it's better. Keep your weight up. Now, certainly we want to be conscientious about weight loss, but we also want to think about what there are different types of weight loss. You know, we have patients, I'm sure all of us, or our clients who come in and, you know, they're overweight. They are maybe 50, 60 pounds overweight. And when you make proper nutritional interventions, they may lose weight. And this might be during cancer treatment. And it may actually be very productive weight loss and very helpful weight loss, resulting in improvements in blood sugar control, and inflammatory trends, and whatnot. So really we need to be, you know, I'm showing this slide, and hopefully it'll be available somehow. We'll figure out a way to get it. If not, we'll have it available on our website for the clinic, and you can just come in and download it. You know, we do want to eliminate weight loss of lean body mass. So what we'll do in our office is we'll look at body compositions, and we'll do BIA or bioimpedance analysis, not for the purposes of weight loss, but actually for the purposes of determining, is the weight loss that we're seeing in cancer patients, for example, productive weight loss, a healthy weight loss? And that's where we're going to see changes in fat mass as opposed to lean body mass. And it's actually those changes which are more of a concern. So why do I bring this right off the bat? Well, because it's really the one main consideration, one main concern for most oncologists and nurses and so on. They're trained to ask questions. Weight loss is always a bad thing. So it's important to be aware of it. Cachexia is a metabolic syndrome, and it's essentially caused by really primarily by increased tumor energy demand. And essentially, as cancers become larger, they take up a lot of energy. They use up sugar, and we'll talk a little bit about this later as an opportunity for nutritional interventions. But ultimately, they can starve. You know, most patients don't die of the cancer per se. They die of starvation because the cancer essentially starves the body for energy. It also cannot be caused just of the tumor demands, but because of inflammatory reactions and immune reactions that are going on alongside, because these, again, are strongly energy-dependent processes. And then, you know, secondarily, it can be caused because of starvation, you know, and that can be a variety of different causes that cause starvation. You know, certainly it could be, you know, just nausea, vomiting, anorexia or loss of appetite. And, starvation can occur by eating the wrong foods, you know. In addition, we can have impaired digestion and absorption. You know, we have some patients with gastrointestinal tumors where they're blocking. You can't swallow food. So there can be a variety of result, you know, variety of causes for significant weight loss in cancer. However, again, when we look at weight loss and if you employ some of these techniques with clients, with patients, you will see weight loss, but it's important to determine whether that weight loss is good weight loss or whether that weight loss is bad weight loss. There is a difference. Because actually all the research points that actually reducing caloric demand or reducing calories and reducing sugars during chemotherapy, for example, results in a better response. So there is a bit of a battle here that weight loss, significant weight loss is bad, but caloric restrictions are good. And it might be hard to reconcile, but again, it's looking at the type of weight loss, the type of calories, and that's really the key thing. So conventional goal is essentially, you know, I'm seeing now a little bit more dietary counseling, although it is all over the map. You know, we see dietitians doing this. We see nutritionists, although I'm not sure the qualifications of the nutritionists that are administering the device. I see good, and I see really bad advice. And so, you know, it's clear to be aware that individuals may be getting advice to varying degrees of expertise over their treatment, and that obviously can create confusion for a lot of patients. You know, where you've told them one thing and they're being told something else. However, usually if you do a comprehensive... So the dietary programs that we put out in our clinic, you know, they're quite comprehensive, quite detailed, very different than what they get from conventional dietitians or nutrition experts. And so essentially, you know, they kind of have a look at it and go, okay, this is... You're telling me, you know, a list of three or four do's and don'ts, and this is a more comprehensive program. So, but at the same time, there is obviously confusion. The goal mainly for them is just to increase the calorie count by 450 kilocalories per day, no matter what. No matter what. Doesn't matter what kind of calories they are. Just get more into them if they're losing weight. So don't be surprised if they're told, no, eat whatever you want. Eat cakes, eat cookies, eat ice cream, eat whatever. Again, it's actually not an evidence-based approach. You know, the interesting thing is actually there's a statistic based out of a study done about a year ago that looked at evidence-based practices, and conventional medicine is really steeped in this concept of everything we do is evidence-based. Everything we do is evidence-based. The reality of it is less than a quarter of what's done in conventional oncology is actually evidence-based. You know, and diet counseling is one example of that. So when we talk about naturopathic approaches, or particularly with nutritional, you know, our goal of treatment needs to be decided. And really, you know, this is one of the things when I speak with naturopathic doctors is... When we see a patient with cancer, our first jump in is to say, oh, what can we give that either through diet or through botanicals or through orthomolecular nutrition or whatnot that's going to halt this cancer? And while, of course, that's intuitive, there are different goals for patients at different parts in the treatment. If a patient's undergoing chemotherapy, I don't need to be an aggressive, try to do aggressive natural chemotherapy at that point in time. My goal should be more supportive. Supporting and reducing side effects wherever possible, supporting therapy efficacy. So we want to pick, well, what are we doing here? And from a dietary perspective, that's absolutely true as well. I don't have one diet for cancer patients. We actually have about 3.5 different diets that we give for cancer patients, depending on what our goal is for the dietary interventions for this patient. Because the composition of that diet is very different. And I'll show you that here, but the three different approaches that we take, three and a half. And some of them might fly a little bit in the face of what you may have read, and I'll try and explain it, and I'm open to debate. So here are the four main groups are doing an additive approach with neoadjuvant and adjuvant chemotherapies or conventional treatments or naturopathic treatments or whatnot. And what that means is either before and after surgery, and usually in combination with some sort of conventional approach. Preventative, and this is really important. Now, preventative can be done as a primary prevention. And, you know, who's at risk for cancer? Everyone. You know, if we look at the statistics, 1 in 2 men in their lifetime and 2 in 5 women in their lifetime will develop cancer. So, you know, it's funny. We talk about high-risk populations when we're talking about doing preventative interventions. You know, being alive is at high risk. The fact of the matter is that the rate of cancer has increased significantly. And if we have a minute at the end, I'll talk about how the statistics right now are very misleading about cancer rates. You know, I think a lot of us will have heard about how the rates of cancer are decreasing. The fact of the matter is it's actually incorrect. How the statistics work is they make an adjustment based on the change in the population in age. So our population is getting older, so it's an assumption that the older we get, the more cancers we should get. That's just natural. So what they do is they take the statistic, they take the age range and the statistics for the age range back in 2002, usually most of the time. And then they shift all the rates and they reduce the rates based on the fact that, well, we've gotten older. So if we fix our mix, it's a statistical alteration, then actually our rates are going down. But the reality of it is our rates are on a very steady incline and it has not changed. The actual rates have not changed in the last probably 10, 15 years. And if we actually look at mortality in terms of treatment and how much people survive, you know, how people survive, there's only been a 14% increase in mortality over the last decade. And that's with all the research, probably over $1 trillion in research that's been invested in cancer treatment. And the vast, you know, probably more than half of that 14% is lead time bias or early diagnosis. Meaning, if you diagnose somebody 2 years earlier with a disease, they're going to live 2 years longer, no matter what you do. But because we've engaged in a lot of preventive or surveillance techniques, whether we're talking about mammography or PSA examinations or colonoscopies or whatnot. And there are advantages to early diagnosis for sure, but there is a bit of a lead time bias that's happening as a result of it. So it's skewing the results. Mm-hmm. Okay. So anyways, this is one of the reasons why we need to look radically different at the problem of cancer. So, you know, one of the most important things when we're looking at cancer is the role of sugars. Back in, 1920s sometime, a Nobel laureate, Otto Warburg, discovered the Warburg effect. And that is that cancer cells have substantially increased glycolysis in the presence of oxygen. So whereas normal cell metabolism will go to an aerobic method in the presence of oxygen, cancer cells are predominantly anaerobic glycolytic, meaning that sugars are converted to lactic acid, as opposed to sugars being converted into pyruvate and going into the electron transport chain for greater energy, which is a more efficient energy source. Didn't know why that was, but did find this. Now, not every cancer has this hallmark. You know, there are always exceptions to every rule. There are some that are highly aerobic, particularly lung cancers. There are many that are highly aerobic, but the vast majority fit this. You know, if we look at the diagnostic imaging, and I've written up here is FDG PET, this is a new scan that actually has a tremendous amount of potential in prognosis, diagnosis, recurrence, and I think we're going to see it used more and more. And it's where they inject the radioactive sugar into a patient and look where it accumulates. And when it accumulates highly in particular areas, it's often a reflection of a cancerous process. So this is a great diagnostic. In addition, not only if it accumulates intensely, or if there's a heavy accumulation within a cancerous process, it also indicates an aggressive a cancerous process. So the more uptake of sugar into a particular area, the more aggressive the cancer is. So this is something that is actually well known. It's being used in diagnostics. So it's not really an argued principle, although I constantly have patients telling me that they're told by their conventional oncologist that sugars mean nothing. They're meaningless. And again, so this again flies in the face of some evidence. So there is a thought of why would there be this glycolytic effect? And one of the reasons is it's thought to have an adaptive significance in rapidly dividing cells by actually reducing reactive oxygen species. So actually a glycolytic process, not through the normal electron transport chain, makes less oxidation. And this is a protective mechanism for these rapidly dividing cells. So that's the theory behind this. When we look at things like chemotherapeutics, part of the mechanism that they work is generating oxidation. If we look at something like vitamin C, which is a traditional antioxidant, when we use it in cancer care, actually in very high doses, it stops being an antioxidant. It's actually a pro-oxidant. It actually makes oxidation species. So this is one of the ways that we can affect cancer cells. So how does it do this? Like, you know, how does the cancer cell preferentially use sugars, and how does that, you know, helpful, and how does it increase the invasive potential of the cancer process? Well, there are some genetic mutations, and one is something called TKTL1 that stands for something called the transketolase enzyme. And essentially what it does is this enzyme, there are two ways in which we can get sugars. We can get sugars from sugar, and then actually certain amino acids and certain fatty acids can be reverse engineered into sugar. They can be broken down and go into the electron transport chain in the mitochondria to produce energy. And these TKTL1 enzymes should function to do this, to prevent them from becoming a sugar and going through glycolysis. It should take them into the normal electron transport chain. And what happens is in cancer cells is there's a mutation. And so it actually shunts them into this gluconeogenesis, or the production of sugars. Now, this is actually a very important phenomenon. You know, you might think, well, this is all just biochemistry babble, which it is. But the reason why it's actually important is because amino acids and fats are often blocked from becoming an energy source in cancer cells. So what it means is that unlike normal cells that can use a protein and fats for energy, cancer cells, for the vast majority, cannot. They require sugars for their energy source. They cannot convert amino acids or proteins and fats into an energy source. So this is an important, again, this is important therapeutic potential. So while it is biochemistry babble, it actually, when we break it right down into the nuts and bolts of how do we affect the patient's diet, it's actually quite meaningful and not that hard. The other possibility is when we have spikes in sugars, we get an induction of IGFs. These are insulin-like growth factors. Okay, so we all know that when you eat a lot of sugar, insulin spikes up. This is one of the problems why people develop type 2 diabetes, is we get these spikes of insulin over a period of time. The body becomes less sensitive to it. One of the hallmarks of type 2 diabetes is a high insulin level and a high sugar. Basically, the body has stopped responding to insulin. Well, why is that a problem? Well, it's a problem because insulin is a growth factor. So what it does is it fuels growth. When we have high levels of insulin, it fuels cellular growth. Now, this is adaptive in kids. It's useful. We need these insulin-like growth factors. We need insulin to help kids grow. This is why diabetic patients, type 1, where there is no insulin, often are smaller because they don't have the growth factors. But in the case of cancer, this is, you know, deadly. This is why diabetics have an increased risk of cancer. So, you know, this is also a story that's not told to diabetics. Diabetics, most of them are aware that, you know, retinopathy or eye problems, nephropathy, kidney problems, cardiovascular problems and circulatory problems, and neuropathies or nervous problems are their main, the main risk. But actually cancer, you know, diabetic patients, whether it's type 1 or type 2, mainly type 2 actually, are at a more than threefold increase for a variety of different cancers. Genes and areas and receptors that respond to insulin. And so it turns on growth factor receptors, what we call tyrosine kinase. These are all cell signaling that tells the cell to divide and to not die. Another problem with high sugar levels and the high sugar recruitment by cancer cells is the production of lactic acid or lactate. What happens is the cancer cell preferentially absorbs blood sugars. It then produces lactic acid. Remember this glycolytic process. I mean, we've all experienced this when we're doing, weights, or if you don't do weights, or you lift something heavy, or run, or whatever, where you get a bit of a burn in the muscle. That's lactic acid. Well, what's happening here is the cancer cell is creating its own lactic acid. This is a huge issue because what it does is the lactic acid sits like a cloud around a tumor. And that actually inhibits immune cell function. And it actually causes what we call immune tolerance or tumor tolerance for the immune system. This is a hallmark of cancer development. Essentially, our body should see cancer cells and say, hey, these guys are bad. Let's get rid of them. And what happens is it ignores them. It says, oh, okay, we'll let it be. And part of the reason for that is because of this lactic acid component. And this is probably another feature of the metabolic elements. So one of the other things that we want to do with our diet is be a little more alkaline wherever possible, And not just diet, but lifestyle in general. This is a phenomenon that's well known and well recognized in Europe, but here in North America, it's like we're talking about something, mm-hmm. from the Twilight Zone. Acid? Come on. No. Here in North America, medical doctors and healthcare practitioners know acute acidosis in the circulatory system, but don't understand chronic acidosis in the connective tissue. So this is one of the problems. Again, this is a feature of sugar. Ultimately, what we want to do, and you'll see it later in our aggressive dietary interventions, is cut the carbohydrates down very low and instead use fat and proteins as a principal energy source in these patients. And in fact, there are quite a few case reports, preclinical studies, and there's a clinical trial going on right now in Europe that looks at doing this. And so far, so good. It's pretty successful. Now, remember that that dietary approach, and I'll go into a little bit more detail, is a treatment diet, mm-hmm. not a preventive diet. Mm-hmm. Because actually when we talk about a preventive diet, completely opposite to that, well, not that we emphasize starches and carbohydrates, but we certainly don't emphasize animal protein or protein in general. Mm-hmm. However, it's key to remember that a carbohydrate-restricted diet is a specific treatment diet. Mm-hmm. It is not a healthy diet that we give to every patient because eating lots of protein and fat is a good thing to do. So, as a caveat, this is the dietary principles that we have patients, live by during conventional treatments. And when we're talking about conventional treatments, we're talking about chemotherapy, radiation, and targeted agents. So, the principles for this kind of therapy is, one, maintain adequate caloric intake. So, again, we don't want them to lose weight unless they need to lose weight. If they need to lose weight because they're having a lot of adiposity and they're overweight, then we want actually a healthy, gradual weight reduction, losing fat mass, not lean body mass. We want to reduce the intake of foods that are difficult to digest because, for example, chemotherapeutics, one of the toxic effects of chemotherapeutics is paralysis of the digestive system and a reduction in the motility or essentially the digestive process, so things slow down. This is why patients get nauseous and vomit and so on. So we don't want to give them foods that are hard to digest and just make this worse. We want to emphasize foods that are nutrient dense, but not simple carbohydrate heavy. So, we don't want things that are starchy or sweet. I think, it's intuitive. We want to emphasize foods that are anti-inflammatory in nature. So there are certain foods that are inherently more inflammatory than other foods, and we want to get rid of those ones from the diet. We want to counsel patients on small, frequent meals rather than large ones. Again, it's based on this principle that there's delayed gastric emptying time, there's slowed down digestion. So if they try and eat big meals, it's just going to make things worse. And we often will supplement the diet with a hypoallergenic protein drink. We often will use pumpkin seed protein, which, I find is really nice. It's hypoallergenic. It's a complete vegetarian protein, and it has demulcent effects. You can use others, but please be cautious with ones that have fructose in it and the other junk that we know that's in a lot of these drinks. Because fructose, albeit that it is metabolized as a fat, it's metabolized as a fat. It's got other problems with it. There's only one company, it's Omega Nutrition. It's the only one I know of that makes a pumpkin seed. The one problem with pumpkin seed protein is it doesn't really, its texture is pumpkin seedy. Right. So it's not, you know, if patients are really sensitive, it's not the best one. We'll also use, Douglas Labs makes a pretty good one as well. It's called the Ultra Protein Plus. It's a little bit too sweet, so, you know. I believe that Progressive also makes a pretty good one. I want to say Phytoberry. I don't use it very much. Usually those are the two that we'll use. I'm not a big fan of whey protein, so I don't put that into the... and there's two reasons for that. One, during chemotherapy, whey actually will increase glutathione levels. And glutathione during chemotherapy is very dangerous. Glutathione is actually a resistance factor for chemotherapeutics. So cancer cells become resistant to chemotherapy by increasing their glutathione production. So you really want to avoid glutathione during chemotherapy. Glutathione is wonderful just about everything else. The only thing that's not great with it is this kind of situation. Mm-hmm. Same thing with radiation treatment. You got to be really careful with antioxidants, particularly glutathione, alpha-lipoic acid, other recyclers of glutathione, N-acetylcysteine, and so on, during radiation treatment. The cells that produce more glutathione survive. And if we push glutathione, those ones that are making intermediate level will survive more and will tend to push the body towards more resistance. So it's really important to avoid some of those antioxidants that feed into what we call multi-drug resistance. And that's an example. So anything that increases glutathione, you want to avoid during chemotherapy. Now, people say, but there's research to show that people tolerate chemo better when they have some of these things. Absolutely. But there's also research to show that it works less. And so if a patient is undergoing chemotherapy, we sure as hell don't want them to go through fire and then end up finding it was a waste because we did something to neutralize it. So what are the specific recommendations that we have? Well, all fruits and vegetables should be cooked or juiced. And when I say juice, I don't mean like with the Vitamix blender juicers. I mean a juice extractor where the fiber goes off to the side. And the reason being is that this is hard to digest. Avoid toxic foods. In the toxic foods, we have the fish that you want to avoid because of high levels of mercury, PCBs, cadmium. We have fish and seafood. We have the Dirty Dozen. Those are the highest pesticide-containing fruits and vegetables. Mainly it's your fruits, you know, apples, pears, peaches, grapes, celery, plums. Any of us who've had a fruit tree in your backyard, you know how pain in the butt these fruit trees can be to raise and why, from a commercial perspective, they're sprayed like crazy. And then, of course, why we recommend organic free-range meats and poultry. Okay. Now, we do not have a vegetarian diet. If patients want to be vegetarian, absolutely they can be during this for this diet. The carbohydrate restricted, it's impossible to be vegetarian and do this. So somebody who's a strict vegetarian and doesn't want to change that, they're not a candidate for that type of diet. But certainly being vegetarian. In the case of vegetarian, though, what we want to try and do is fermented legumes like tofu, tempeh. And the reason being is that fermentation process helps break down some of the fiber and helps to make it easier to digest. If you do lots of legumes like lentils and beans and so on, not the fresh ones, but the dried ones in particular, and again, it creates gas, and it's going to be a problem for these patients undergoing these treatments. Soups and broths, lots of these. We recommend an alkaline broth as a base that they can use and then add in whatever they like. Again, by making soups, we put some of the amino acids from something like a chicken noodle soup or whatever. We put that we break them down into single and either di or tripeptide. So they're very easy to digest. So soups and broths are great. We do recommend gluten-free grains because these are hypoallergenic grains. Corn is the one exception to that. So there are some patients that do react with corn as well. But certainly quinoa, buckwheat, amaranth, millet, these are all good grains that they can have. Ginger and licorice tea can be very, very useful. Now the problem is, even patients who love ginger during chemotherapy can often develop an aversion to ginger. Okay, so we will often give ginger as a supplement. Why? It's one of the best natural antiemetics. and it won't interfere with anything else that's being given. And it's been clinically shown to reduce the use of conventional antiemetics or anti-nausea medication. So ginger is a very, very useful, herb to be during conventional treatments. Now, it's really important that you're cautious with fats and oils. So we will supplement with fish oils during chemotherapy and radiation therapy for two reasons. It reduces side effects of these treatments, and it increases the effectiveness. The problem is if you use too much dietary fats and oils, it also slows down the stomach from digesting. It delays gastric emptying time. So it will worsen nausea. So if you have patients who are nauseous, not tons of butter, not tons of oil, you want to back that off. Actually, probably the best fat would be butter for them, because it's a short and medium chain triglyceride. Make sure it's organic, because butter has the highest levels of PCBs. Non-organic butter has the highest levels of PCBs of any food we eat. You can also look at coconut butter as well as an alternative to butter. And again, these are wonderful saturated fats. So again, where patients might have lower appetite levels, these are great. We also use macadamia nut butter for these patients, because a tablespoon of macadamia nut butter is 220 calories. It's a great calorie-packed meal. However, it is a fat, so you do have to be cautious in the same way here. And then, as I mentioned here, some hypoallergenic protein powders, Ultra Protein Plus, pumpkin seed protein. If you do want to use a whey, use Immune Ultra. It's from AOR. It's a beta-lactoferrin-containing whey, but I do not recommend it. So the don'ts. No dairy. So that, of course, includes milk, cheese, cream, yogurt, ice cream. Butter is not included on that list. No gluten. So barley, rye, wheat, spelt, kamut. I no longer call oats in this, because oats really are gluten-free. The problem is they get contaminated with gluten because they're grown alongside. So you can get gluten-free, wheat-free oats. But even patients who are celiac can often get away with oats. So oats I don't include here. No raw nuts. So we could use things like nut butters, but not whole nuts, again, for this digestive difficulty. No legumes, except for the fermentation, as we talked about earlier. No citrus, no beef, pork, or game meats. And this is because these meats contain high levels of an amino acid called histidine, which is a precursor to histamine. And they happen to be highly inflammatory, not to mention acidic. No eggs.
Why no citrus?
It tends to be a bit inflammatory and mold and fungal, and heavily sprayed. And, it's just one of those problematic ones. Exception to that being lemon and limes. Amen. Oranges, grapefruits. I also include cantaloupes, kiwi in that. Some of the melons, not domestic melon. Mm-hmm. We're talking the stuff that is grown half a world away. This is one of the reasons why these foods can be really big irritants for patients who have like irritable bowel, inflammatory bowel diseases, and so on. So no eggs. And again, this is the high inflammatory nature of the protein, the albumin in that, tends to be quite inflammatory. The yolks are actually quite a bit gentler, calorie-dense, nutrient-dense. Yolks get a bad rap. They're the best part of the egg. Duck, goose, quail, those are all better egg choices. What I would say is restricting it in the first maybe 4 to 7 days after chemo, and then you could probably add those ones in, right? Mm-hmm. But yes, they are much better. One of the other problems with eggs is we've all been vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So we've all been injected with egg albumin, so it kind of primes us for a bit of an allergic type reactivity to eggs. Conventionally, they would dispute that, but I believe that's why we see more egg issues. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No onions and garlic. I know that might come to shock some people, but these are actually highly irritating. They're wonderfully healthy for a variety of other reasons, so I'm not knocking them on a general rule. Onions mm-hmm. and garlic are great, but what happens when you cut an onion? You cry. They're mucous membrane irritants. That's just it. And even by cooking them, you still do that. And alcohol definitely is an avoid for obvious reasons. One, it turns into a sugar, and two, it needs to be worked on by the liver, and the liver is a little busy. There's some additional notes for pelvic and abdominal radiation. So you actually want very little fiber in these situations. I know this might sound completely counterintuitive again, but the number one side effect of abdominal or pelvic radiation is diarrhea. And so the number one treatment that we use nutritionally is white rice. And the reason being is because it's binding in nature. So again, is white rice my recommendation for general health and well-being? Certainly not. But for patients who are receiving pelvic and abdominal radiation, it can be make or break for them. It can really help. It can make all the difference for diarrhea. You want to use foods with some demulcin properties. So we could look at using teas like slippery almond, marshmallow root, licorice tea, ginger, chamomile. We could look at using plantain. These are all sorts of different foods, teas, herbs, etc., that can be included in food. You want to be very cautious with foods that contain high levels of antioxidants. So while you wouldn't necessarily restrict the patient from, let's say, having blueberries, you'd want to make sure they're not having 3 cups of juiced blueberries every day. Because the fact of the matter is we do know antioxidants in radiation, even dietary ones, could interfere with that. And in particular, you want to avoid cod liver oil in these patients. Because cod liver oil has a high level of vitamin A. And vitamin A has been proven time and again in several clinical trials to interfere with the effectiveness of radiation and reduce overall survival. In general, I recommend avoiding vitamin A as much as possible. Vitamin A is just not a vitamin you want either in your multivitamin or whatnot. So try to choose a multi if you do prescribe them. Even with patients who aren't undergoing cancer treatment, choose a multivitamin without vitamin A. Not the same problem with the carotenoids, but certainly vitamin A. Remember, though, when you're talking to patients that the bowel must be clear prior to treatment. So you don't want to advise them doing something before they go in because they need to make sure they void. So you also don't want to constipate them, if that's possible, but you don't want to constipate them. They need to have bowel movements before they go in. Otherwise, it interferes with the effectiveness of the radiation treatment. There's some intricacy in diet therapy with different treatments. So this is why diet's not dogmatic. You know, there are some intricacies. Well, what about preventive approaches? You know, the fact of the matter is 35 to 50% of cancers can be attributed to diet and lifestyle factors. 35 to 50%. Smoking's like 17. Yes, diet and lifestyle factors are the number one preventable risk factor in cancer. And it's huge, absolutely huge. And, you know, one of the problems is that we're seeing worldwide the rate of cancer will double by 2025. And it's because of the developing world, partly because they're developing, one, infections, but two, a more North American lifestyle and food basis. So what are some of the do's from a preventive perspective? Well, we want 5+ servings of vegetables per day. This is the bare minimum, but it also, at that level, shows a substantial risk reduction for a variety of different cancers, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, prostate cancer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think it's been studied in a lot more, but in particular those ones. Now, when would you use this type of preventive approach? I haven't really approached this. Well, you could do this primarily with every individual in the world. I think these approaches are just good sense anyways. You could certainly emphasize them and be militant about them with somebody who's at high risk for developing cancer. And it's certainly, these are all important for patients who have been previously diagnosed with cancer. So we want them to emphasize organic fruits, vegetables, and meats, again, because of the high carcinogen load. I'm very skeptical about organic these days. You do get better quality. There are lower levels of pesticides and commercial fertilizers, but we have to use it with a grain of salt. So I try to recommend local organic wherever possible. And don't be fooled with free or natural meats. That is not organic. It is not organic. Free of truth. And you know what? It's getting more and more accessible. Mm-hmm. You know, it's getting more and more accessible. And then people will say, well, gosh, it's more expensive. And I say, great, you're going to eat less of it. Which is the next recommendation. Eat less eat less animal protein. Okay? Animal proteins, so we're talking about chicken, turkey, fish, lamb. These are lean fat, lean proteins as well. Dairy, cheese, etc., which are the less desirable ones. Really, it should be less than 15% of calorie intake, but certainly less than 25%. In North America, it's around 40%. That's about the average animal protein intake is around 40%. So what we tell patients is when they're putting their plate together, half the plate of vegetable, leafy green preferably, quarter of the plate an animal protein, preferably lean, chicken, turkey, fish, lamb. I know lamb's not lean, but it's a gentle meat. Another quarter of the plate, a whole starch, a whole grain starch, like a brown rice or quinoa or whatnot, and then a tablespoon of good fat. And that's kind of how you make your plate. So that leads us to the next one, which is whole grains. Again, proven to reduce the risk of things like colorectal cancer, breast cancer, and so on. Now, I'm going to use that term a lot when we talk about this because that's where most of the research has gone into, because that's where the money goes for this kind of research, right? It doesn't mean that it hasn't been shown to reduce the risk of other cancers. It's just less money. It's less, I don't want to say attractive, but there's less research. It is less attractive. There's less attention put to the other cancers. You know, the number one killer is lung cancer, and it's, I think, number 5 or 6 on the funding scale because it's not as attractive. Not attractive. I would say, nobody's championed it in the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, attractive is really a bad way to say it. But it isn't vogue, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that breast cancer is vogue, but it's been championed. You know, people have really taken it on, and I believe that's what just needs to happen mm-hmm. in lung as well. Having said that, at what point in time do we stop wasting our money on research we already know the answer to? That's a whole other question. Alcohol. So in general, we want to limit alcoholic beverages to no more than 4 per week and no more than 2 at a time or 2 within a day. That is the level that has been shown to have, so far, is the level to show risk in high-risk individuals. This was research out of both breast and colorectal cancer and showed that certainly at this level, those patients who are at highest risk for recurrence had an increased rate of recurrence if they drank beyond this amount per week. So the World Health Organization says no more than 2 drinks a day, which is 14 a week, and we're saying 4 here. Emphasize anti-cancer foods. See the handout. We'll get you that. But, you know, really vegetables, cruciferous vegetables, green tea. Now, green tea, you got to drink a heck of a lot of it. It's not sort of your... And you got to drink quality green tea. Okay, I've got a tea room in my... I'm a bit of a tea snob, so... But you want to get loose tea. There is a huge difference in the quality and the amount of polyphenols and antioxidants in the tea of a loose leaf green tea versus a dried. Because, you know, basically they're the dust. It's the very lowest grade. In addition, don't use the teas with these new pyramid. They're in a nylon, right? They're actually, I mean, they're cool. I love them. I think they're a great idea because they're a loose tea in this tea bag. We hate to pick stuff out. But the fact of the matter is it's a nylon, it's plastic that you're putting in hot water. Pomegranate. Every patient, every man, male patient especially, should be on pomegranate. You know, it's the one thing that's been shown to reduce the risk of prostate cancer, heart disease, and in patients with prostate cancer, really prevent recurrence or delay recurrence significantly. 1 cup a day. Actually, the research has all been done by Pombran, which is not an organic pomegranate, but... all the research has been done by them. Very interesting. Other anti-cancers. So when we look at alcohol, you'll see that wine often shows up because of these wonderful antioxidants that are in wine. And one of the major ones that's been very popularized is resveratrol, okay? Mm-hmm. Which definitely is a wonderful antioxidant, has a whole bunch of other properties. But here's the catch. The wine that contains the most amount of resveratrol, and it was actually found here in Ontario, it was a Merlot. Shocking, because I hate Ontario red wine. But anyways, and they're actually relatively young vines, which is rare because they have to be on actually old vines with noble rot on them. They need actually fungal. The resveratrol is produced as a protective mechanism to this fungus. Going segueing here. Anyways, the fact of the matter is 30 milligrams per liter is the quantity. 30 milligrams per liter. From a treatment perspective, you need about 200 to 400 milligrams a day.
Gosh.
I mean, you'd be pickled before you have any preventive effects of this. What we do believe is, okay, but that we can't argue with the fact that a drink a day in many different studies have shown to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease and cancer in some populations. It's pretty strong evidence. The reason behind this is believed to be actually the stress-relieving effects of a drink a day. And it's also one of the reasons that we know that actually when you go beyond a drink a day from a nervous system perspective, you actually cause a stronger rebound and actually can be more stress provoking. I believe there are healthier stress management tools than drinking. So that's what I try and encourage my patients. But I just want to make a comment on that as a food that really doesn't have that. soy is another thing that gets a bad rap. The biggest issue with soy is it's genetically modified almost all over. And, you know, eventually we're not going to be able to trust the non-GMO stuff. And it's not because they're lying. It's because of contamination. Most stuff that is non-GMO, the seeds just, the fact is they get contaminated and they become genetically modified. And we just don't know what that does. There's substantial cause for concern that it's going to be a long-term risk. But soy is a nice preventive. It does not cause breast cancer. There's arguments on whether it prevents it. If it's an Asian study, it prevents it. If it's a North American study, it doesn't prevent it. I don't know why that is, but that's really different. So it might be the population. Maybe Asian people, maybe the metabolism is different, and therefore they respond to it. But there hasn't been a good study that showed, that not been a good study not sponsored by the dairy industry, that showed any increase in I kid you not. Actually, the two that showed a risk were sponsored by the dairy industry, which is tostados. But anyways, the fact of the matter is soy is okay. Flax, another great one, okay, and fiber in general, but flax is a good type of fiber. So these are some examples of some foods that have potential anti-cancer effects. Drinking reverse osmosis filtered water is also very important. The fact of the matter is our water supply, albeit clean from a microorganism perspective, and I'm not arguing with that, I mean, with some rare exceptions, it has a lot of other contaminants that that we can't filter out. There's no way they're going to be able to filter it. Listen, you don't want to filter your toilet water. You know, so we use reverse osmosis. Now, there's arguments against reverse osmosis. The arguments against it are that it removes all the minerals. How are minerals transported in the body? Active transport. They have transporters. They don't diffuse by osmosis. Cells in our intestine grab it and bring it into us. Why is that important? Well, it means that if you drink reverse osmosis filtered water, it doesn't mean it's not going to suck the minerals out of you. What it does mean is it won't give you minerals. And so the research that went into looking at reverse osmosis or demineralized waters and showed that there was lower mineral content or lower mineral levels in the people who were taking this was because they were on a low mineral diet. They actually had crappy diets. So what was happening is when they drank the tap water or mineralized water, they were getting their minerals from the tap water. The fact is if people are getting their main source of minerals, their water, we're in deep trouble, which we are. So we're not going to get it sucked out of us. We're not going to get a deficiency as long as we're getting our minerals from everywhere else. People also will make a complaint, well, if you water your plants with water, they die. With reverse osmosis filtered water, they die. So I don't want to – I've heard this argument. Well, I don't want to drink water that kills my plant. Well, yeah, but your plant can't go out and kill your cat and eat it or kill another plant and eat it. You know, they have to rely on water. That is their nutritional source. So the problem with reverse osmosis filtered water is a little bit acidic, but that's okay. It's acidic because of carbon dioxide being dissolved into it, which actually precipitates out in the body and becomes carbonic acid, which actually becomes a buffer. So it's not highly acidic, okay? Distilled is dead. It is not good water. It's highly reduced, very low low redox potentials in it. So we don't recommend that, but reverse osmosis is important.
Do you have an opinion on the Kangen water, the alkaline water?
My opinion on that is as long as you're starting with something clean, I don't care what you do with it afterwards. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about it to, I mean, mm-hmm. I've read about it.
Mm-hmm.
I've read the information on it. I don't have enough information that I believe the claim. But I don't have enough information to say I disbelieve the claim. But in my opinion, I want clean water. So mm-hmm. what you do with it afterwards, you put it through an ion, you octagonalize it, you kangenize it, you alkalinize it. The problem with alkaline water is you're using sodium hydroxide as your alkalizer. But the main biological buffer in the body is sodium bicarbonate.
Mm-hmm.
So we measure pHs in people's blood, saliva, and urine. Particularly blood and urine is the most important when we're looking at body pHs. And I've yet to see a patient who's drinking alkaline water where it's actually alkalinized them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think it gets into the system. Bicarbonates, if I give them bicarbonate within 15 minutes, their pH changes, it absorbs it very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why it's baking soda. I mean, fancy baking soda, but it's baking soda, I think, is a better buffer and saves them $1,000 or so for the machines. But my answer to it is that, you know, I don't know enough about it, but as long as we're starting with clean. The problem that I have is they have these, I've seen these, the filters they're not, they don't take out enough. Okay. And we have checked that and they just don't take out enough. Okay. So if they put a reverse osmosis filter first and then did it, I'd be very supportive of it. I think that's the only thing that's missing on. The last thing is eating a variety of foods. And this is really important. Most individuals get into a monotonous, repetitive, eating the same foods all the time. And this is actually very dangerous. So it's important to have variety. So this is why we actually are in our, on our patient resource area, we're creating online recipes because patients give us these recipes. So what are the don'ts? Well, avoid food on the toxic food list, avoid dairy protein, and avoid allergenic foods for sensitive individuals, amongst the other don'ts that we sort of talked about, like don't eat a lot of animal protein and so on. So now, what about our aggressive diet? So this is an active diet, and the idea here is to starve cancer cells and to reduce insulin levels, which reduces a growth factor. So the diet itself is actually based on the Coy approach. He's a doctor, a geneticist from Germany. Sorry, he's a geneticist, a PhD, not a medical doctor. And he's done a lot of the research on the TKTL1 mutation that I talked about earlier. And it's based on the principle of limiting carbohydrates, total carbohydrates, to 40 to 60 grams per day. Now, that won't put a patient into ketoacidosis. It is slightly ketogenic, although not significantly. And the types of carbohydrates that we want to encourage are the leafy green vegetables, right? We don't want those 40 to 60 grams to be a piece of toast. We want it to be broccoli and kale and collard greens and all those kinds of things, Brussels sprouts, etc. So the emphasis is actually on proteins and fat as the main calorie source. Now there is care with nausea and vomiting, care with acid-base balance, and care with significant weight loss, because most people's major source of calories is carbohydrate. So when you take patients off of the carbohydrates, if they don't have... If they can't make up their calories quickly with proteins and fats, they're going to lose weight significantly, and they're going to lose lean body mass. It's not going to be good weight loss. So this is something that, you know, they need to make sure that they're adequately supported and they're getting lots of calories out there. Now, the original Tavarlin diet that's from Germany is full of wonderfully healthy calories like sausage. I mean, it's just typical German crappy food. I mean, the fact of the matter is it's not the kinds of proteins you want to look at, and there's not enough emphasis on vegetables. But basically, if we look at the revised plan that we have, there's a green section, and this is stuff that's all you can eat. You can clean meats, easy to digest dairy. So these are things like goat dairy in particular, non-starchy vegetables, and those are leafy greens in particular. And it's possible to add low net carbohydrate foods here. We have a yellow list where there's daily limits of really bioflavonoid rich fruits, but they can be high in sugars. And essentially they can have one or two orange thrice weekly limits. Basically they can have sort of one of the selections three times a week. And this is higher sugar containing fruits. And then we have a red diet, red zone, which is a no fly zone, high carbohydrate, you know, and there's some good things in that. Like, pomegranate, for example, couldn't do. Because it's a high sugar fruit. Bananas, quinoa. Okay, so these are all really very good foods, but they're just high starch, high carbohydrate foods. And again, the goal here is to keep the carbohydrates below 40 to 60 grams. Now, if a patient can't do this, what we'll try and do is at least get the insulin levels down. So what we'll try and do is we'll give them a modified version of this plan and then try and give them some sort of something we give diabetics. Basically trying to give them, Gymnema, Corella, different herbs, cinnamon, etc., to try and lower blood sugar, increase insulin sensitivity to reduce insulin levels. And we would put patients on this where if they were undergoing chemotherapy and they were tolerating extraordinarily well, there's some patients where they do chemotherapy and it's like they're not doing anything. I mean, they feel tired. It's rare, but it happens. And those patients, let's give them this. We wouldn't give them the supportive plan because they don't need a lot of support. Let's get aggressive. Let's do the two of them together. Patients who are on palliative therapies or patients who are on sort of low-dose chronic chemotherapeutic strategies. Now, there are other nutritional philosophies, so I do want to mention them because they're out there, and I'll give you my 2 cents on them. And by the way, all this is my opinion. I'll try and put some of it based on some research as well. But, if I'm poo-pooing on something, please don't take it personally. If it's something that you do, I'm just trying to give you some feedback of why I think it's valuable or not valuable, as the case may be. So one common one is the Budwig protocol. And, you know, out of all the ones I'm going to talk about, it's one that I'm supportive of. It really was originally used with cork, flaxseed oil with cork. And it's, you know, essentially it's put in a blender. And the blending, you know, it's magically, it makes a sense it's magically more easy to absorb. It isn't. It's just emulsifying the fats. So basically it's a simple way to emulsify the fats, which are just easier to digest. So this was done by Budwig, and she believed the therapeutic effects are based on the principles of Warburg and using fats. I don't agree with that completely. The research is back in the 50s, and there's a lot that's changed between the 50s and now. I actually believe more of it relates to the anti-inflammatory actions of flax oil, and how it affects tumor metabolism and the production of invasive cofactors and pro-inflammatory cytokines and these types of things that increase the invasive nature of a cancer cell. So it still works. I might disagree about how she thinks it works, but it works. Okay. Now I will give fish oil and I believe it will have the same effect, but if a patient says, I've been doing this, I want to do this, I never poo-poo on it. Absolutely go ahead, do it. It's fine. Gerson. This is another very popular dietary protocol. Max Gerson created this protocol about back in the 50s and 60s, and it involves 13 plus fresh fruit and vegetable juices per day. The key here is it's fresh. So you can imagine how that would be in terms of the patients who have done this before actually hired people to do this for them, because it's almost impossible to do it on your own. Then you're also given 3 to 4 coffee enemas per day, and also in combination with supportive SSKI, supersaturated potassium iodide, as a thyroid supportive therapy, and then on a strictly vegan diet. There are some very compelling cases in his books. I've never seen it work. I've just never seen it work on a patient. I've seen patients at the beginning feel better. I mean, who wouldn't? 13 plus juices a day, you're getting a tremendous impact. The problem is over time, what are all those juices? They're sugar. I mean, one of the major ones that he does is apple, and I mean, it's sugar. It's actually feeding the process. Patients end up starving, they lose lean body mass, and I've yet to see it work once at all. Now, have I had 30 patients, 40 patients who have done it? No. I've had about 10 or 11 who've tried, and only 3 or 4 have actually succeeded for any period of time. It's just prohibitively, it's almost impossible. So for me, when I see a protocol that's almost impossible, I call it the excuse protocol, meaning, and I've seen this happen with a lot of practitioners, is, well, it didn't work because the patient didn't do it. It's the excuse. There's an excuse why it didn't work. Listen, I wish every time I treated a patient, they got better and were cured. I would love to be able to claim that, not because of some sort of self-satisfying ego, but I just would love to have all of our patients live. And unfortunately, that's not the situation. I don't have any miraculous cures. I never blame a patient for it. And I hate when I see protocols like this. I don't think the protocol is the issue, but be careful when you blame a patient for poor results. If a protocol is concocted that they're going to fail, and this is an example of one, as I said, you have to have a ton of money to pay somebody to do it. Those are the only people who have actually been able to do it, and none of them had a great success story from it. Again, that's a case of 3 or 4 patients who did it for any period of time. But there are clinics that people can go to for a couple weeks at a time and have this treatment done. There's one in Ontario, and there are several in the States. And it's much easier. But again, it's very challenging. You can imagine 3 to 4 coffee enemas a day and 13, 14, 15, 16 fresh juices a day. Yeah. You know, I mean, just because somebody passes away during cancer treatment, it doesn't mean it's bad treatment. Because life's a terminal illness. And sometimes when we do everything we can, but, you know, we're human at this point in time. As I said, I wish I knew more. And I'm very open to supporting. I don't generally knock things unless I see that they don't work. The problem that happens is the reason why I'm being, I guess, as forceful with the Gerson protocol is patients beat themselves up over it. Mm-hmm. So the patients who tried it really beat themselves up. Oh, I'm getting worse because I'm just not doing it. And I tried to emphasize, I wouldn't be able to do it. You could put a gun to my head and I wouldn't do that. I couldn't be able to do it. I just, You know, I'm lucky if I can take a few supplements in the morning on a regular basis. Come on, I'm a guy. So I can well imagine how challenging it is. And that's the part that frustrates me, because people beat themselves up, and I think it gets involved in this sort of self-defeatist process. Mm-hmm. Anyways, raw. So this is kind of a la Hippocrates process, everything raw, everything vegetarian in particular. And it's based on the principle that animal protein is carcinogenic, which to a certain extent is correct. High amounts of animal protein are cancer-causing. Raw foods contain enzymes that assist in digestion, and raw foods are more alkaline. And it's a very vitalistic philosophy, so there's a certain righteous element to this. As a treatment, as a preventive strategy, I believe it works. As a treatment strategy, again, the issue here, again, is high carbohydrates. In addition, very hard to digest, so it actually makes people quite sick who are doing any type of conventional treatment. As a reparative, restorative treatment after cancer, conventional cancer therapies, I've seen it work very effectively. So because usually the people who are doing this are people who are just devitalized. They were eating crap beforehand.
Right.
And they get onto this highly vital food, highly nutrient dense, and they just feel good. So I believe it has a possible place with people with relatively good digestive systems who are not involved in active cancer treatment in terms of conventional cancer treatment with chemotherapy, radiation, and as a preventive strategy. And then there's fasting, and I've seen this several times. And this is often, I see it, a 60-day fast with some sort of fruit juice. Grapes is often the grape diet I've seen quite a bit. And it's based on this principle of starving cancer cells, but it's very dangerous. I've had two patients who have reported knowing somebody who did very well with it. I've never seen it work well, but I've had patients who've said it worked well. So I'm trusting them because they said they knew the person personally who did it. When a patient decides to do this, we monitor them very carefully. So we do blood work, we do their bioimpedance analysis, and I recommend against it. I believe we can achieve the same with a low carbohydrate approach. I think we can do that, although we've never done a head to head on it. But I believe there are significant dangers with that because this will create cachexia, and in some patients they will not respond to this. Certainly a weak patient you would never do this with. So those are some of the key principles in nutrition and cancer, both from a supportive perspective, from an additive, from an aggressive process, and preventive. And, as I see it, as the research that I've gone through sees it, a lot of this has come about over time. We've massaged this. It's continually evolving. So there's some changes that we make from time to time on this as more research comes to light. But, we've had quite a bit of success with these diets with patients. And really, it's a cheap and easy treatment option for patients' diet. This is why at our clinic, if a cancer patient comes in, included in their intake is an hour with our nutritionist. So they must see the nutritionist. We used to strongly encourage it, and people always wanted to save their money mm-hmm. and not go and see the nutritionist. And so finally we said, forget it, you have to. It's a requirement. So because it really is essential, and I think it makes a big difference. People just don't give it credit, right? I mean, I'm doing all this really advanced targeted therapies and doing all this diagnostics. How can diet make any real difference? And, of course, no oncologist will tend to validate it. That sort of it is not. It doesn't matter. Eat whatever you want. But it really is very important. Did you have any questions?
About supplements.
It really depends. Right? So it depends on, again, so we go back to, well, what's our purpose? Are we doing supportive therapy during conventional treatments? Are we doing palliation? What's the goal? There are a whole host of supplements. I try to keep things as tight and minimal as possible with oral supplements. I do a lot of intravenous therapies and aggressive therapies that way. I find they work well. We do use things like curcumin. We do use things like fish oils. We do use things like some green tea catechins extract, vitamin K. Sometimes we'll use mushroom extracts, although generally we use mistletoe or viscum. Vitamin D, of course. I mean, there's so many different therapeutics. Pomegranate, we talked about. Pie leaf extract, artemisinin. I mean, I could go on. Like there are hundreds. And so a lot of times, again, we're picking what are we doing here. So we often will do supportive therapies. During conventional treatments. And there, our goal is less sort of what can we do to really go after the cancer process and more, well, what do we do to help mitigate side effects? So, you know, some people develop what's called oral mucositis, where they get mouth sores and things like that. So we're doing botanical mouth rinses. We're using glutamine as mouth rinses, probiotics, you know, things like that. So we really, we create sort of basic supportive regimens, and then we'll look at what manifests in patients and the new symptom-specific support. Caution with some of the chemotherapeutics and targeted therapies, anti-hormonal therapies. We do know that I would certainly be concerned patients on tamoxifen and Arimidex or other types of anti-hormonal agents and giving them things like, you know, soy and so on, because those clover or other types of phytoestrogen, there is some potential research showing there might be a negative interaction. But really and truly, that question is, it's a million-dollar question, and it's, I actually spend, so we do a course for naturopathic doctors, it's like 3 days, and we talk about, part of that
we don't have
time. Supplementation. So, you know, simple stuff that you can't go wrong with, vitamin D, fish oil, alkalinizing, although not with meds, because the alkalinizing agents that you might use will actually inhibit certain medications. I guess that wasn't simple. Probiotics are often very simple. And then from there, it gets more complex. I mean, like, that seems like, well, it's the nothing. But really, it gets complex, depending on the chemotherapeutics that's being used, depending on the, you know, what is going on with radiotherapy. Melatonin is probably another very good one that's generally not a huge issue with. So those are the kind of ones that we'll do. And enzymes, proteolytic enzyme, very high dose chymotrypsin, trypsin enzymes. So we use pancreatic enzymes. We use a product called Intenzyme Fort from Biotics, which is a pretty good one. Those are ones that, you know, it's kind of no matter what you're doing, you're probably safe with and important. Any other questions?
What about B12?
B12 can be bad, particularly in myelogenous cancers like leukemias, myelomas, lymphomas. Folic acid is deadly. So folic acid is one of those ones that you really want to avoid. B12 we will use in certain circumstances, because actually without folic acid in high amounts, the B12 is not as destructive, not as potentially encouraging for cancerous growth. But certainly folic acid would be big. And B12, unless it's absolutely necessary. So where we'll use B12 is generally not during active treatment, but let's say somebody has a neuropathy from chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. We'll add in some of the neuroprotective methylcobalamin. But we'll usually wait a few weeks afterwards. And usually part of a neoadjuvant or more of an adjuvant strategy or after treatment.
And I've heard no bioflavonoids.
So the way that we do it is if a treatment hasn't had either some preclinical or clinical research on it, mm-hmm. we won't combine it. And so unfortunately, many bioflavonoids have not had research in combination with chemotherapeutics. If there's at least in vitro or preclinical or animal studies that show a positive synergistic combination, we may use it. It depends on the patient's situation. You know, we'll be a little bit more risky. Or I won't say risky, but we will advise doing things that may have a potential interaction for patients where they're doing palliative chemotherapy, for example, where the goal for chemotherapy is more quality of life and length of life. And so if it's causing a lot of side effects and the quality of life is crap, then, you know, we'll tell patients there might be an interaction here. We're just not sure. And they'll make a decision. Otherwise, we'll err on the side of caution and only use stuff where we know. And in terms of bioflavonoids, for the most part, there aren't really a lot of good research in some chemotherapeutics. There are some, like the platinums, for example, there is some good research with certain bioflavonoids.
Oh, okay.
But for many, there are not. Mm-hmm. You know, quercetin is one of those ones that's always there are some research showing that it actually increases the bioavailability of certain chemotherapeutics and reduces their metabolism. And there are some studies that show that it interferes with the effect. So again, in the case where we see conflicting research, we're going to err on the side of. The exception comes in where we see clinical research or preclinical research showing that it would probably work, that it works well. And then some tiny little study that looks at one aspect of cellular signaling and says, it's bad. You know, in the case where, because I've seen this with curcumin, where they looked at some signaling and then it was on the chatter board for oncology naturopathic docs. And they're like, oh, well, everybody's going to stop using curcumin now because it influenced this one cell signaling factor, even though we actually have clinical research on in a couple of situations. So, I mean, in those cases, the problem is what we're dealing with natural substances are dirty drugs, which is great. They have a lot of different modes of action. So we can't just pick one of them and go, oh, well, that's bad. we have to look at the totality of its effect. And so those are the exceptions we have there. But folic acid is a big one. Vitamin A is a big one you want to avoid. With chemotherapeutic glutathione, N-acetylcysteine, coenzyme Q10, any intracellular antioxidant. So alpha lipoic acid, I think I already said that. I'm trying to think of other intracellular antioxidants off the top of my head. Selenium is questionable, but generally not. You know, we use it with radiation treatments because it's shown some good effects. There's some good clinical research on it. But then you also want to be careful with those bioflavonoids because some of them can be intracellular antioxidants. And there's always this argument, well, some, you know, antioxidants can be good. And you look at, you know, vitamin C is a case in point. Vitamin C is an antioxidant, and it works really well with chemotherapeutics. The problem is that's in very high doses where it ceases to become an antioxidant. It's a prooxidant. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, and extracellular antioxidants, these are things that work on the connective tissue, seem to work well. But the intracellular ones seem to interfere. And antioxidants in general, when you're not doing conventional therapy, probably a good idea. Mm-hmm. The problem is during conventional treatment. That's really where the issue comes in. So what I would say is err on the side of caution. We've compiled about 150 research articles on the combination of conventional and non-conventional therapeutics. And we're actually going to try and put up a doc where people can access it and see. So the evidence is there. But we're still in the formatting phases. So not quite there yet.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Marsden. We really appreciate you taking the time to come out and share such a wealth of information on the topic. And
great.
We've all learned quite a bit.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
For more information on some of the highlights in Dr. Marsden's topic, please see his website at M as in mother, C as in cat, N as in knight, E as in Edward.ca. That's MCNE.ca.